This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Sterobin. Last time on Grapple, we heard about Chester. It's a city near Philadelphia that once had a strong industrial economy. But as manufacturing left town, so did many people, making Chester today one of Pennsylvania's poorest cities that's now grappling with problems like crime and failing schools. If you missed the last episode, be sure to check it out. You'll hear personal stories about some of the economic and social changes that Chester has experienced over the last 60 years.
You can just go right down the street and see the different resources that other cities have. Their kids have a better opportunity than our kids have here in the city of Chester. We just don't have the resources.
And to help us broaden our understanding of those changes, we're going to hear more now about the impact that deindustrialization has had on cities like Chester and what could be done to improve the situation. We'll hear from Amy Liu of the Brookings Institution, where she's vice president and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program.
When we think about the future prospects of communities like Chester, the reality is that the economy and the global economy is rapidly changing. And so we have to constantly adapt our strategies to reflect that reality. And if we don't, places like Chester will fall increasingly behind.
But first, let's get started with Elijah Anderson. He's a professor of sociology at Yale University and the author of numerous books, including A Place on the Corner, Streetwise, Code of the Street, and The Cosmopolitan Canopy. He's currently working on a new book called Black in the White Space. For a long time, Anderson taught at the University of Pennsylvania and continues to do fieldwork in Philadelphia, where we are based. And he's graciously come all the way from New Haven to join us here in the studios of WHYY. So welcome, Elijah, and thanks for making the trip.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about your childhood. You've had quite a journey from childhood to adulthood, so give us a feel for that.
Well, I was born in the Mississippi Delta during the war. My folks were sharecroppers. My grandmother went to the cotton fields. My mother went to the cotton fields. My father went to the cotton fields. And my dad went to the war. And he had a fourth grade education, and he wanted to move north. We were drawn north, part of the Great Migration. And he got a job at Studebaker's, the defunct car manufacturer. My mother worked as a domestic, and I grew up in South Bend. Eventually went off to Indiana University in Bloomington, and then went on to the University of Chicago, where I studied ethnography, and from there wrote my dissertation at Northwestern, and then my first teaching job at Swarthmore College.
And when you were at Swarthmore, part of that time you were doing some research or field work in Chester, right?
Yes.
And what drew you to Chester specifically?
Well, basically, it was a black community that was near Swarthmore, and it was a place where I could get my hair cut. So I was looking for a new project after my dissertation, A Place on the Corner. And so I would go walking around and looking at things. As an ethnographer, this is what we do. We observe, we pay attention to people, we take a lot of notes, and we observe. So this was really a kind of reconnaissance.
What bubbles to the top when you think about what you saw and what you heard and the people you met at that time?
Well, the big thing is that I got a sense that there was a black core and a suburban white ring around the city. That the black people tended to live in the city and the white people lived outside the city. It was classic in that respect. And it was beginning to undergo deindustrialization. The jobs were beginning to leave. And the Sun Oil Company was there and the shipbuilding and that kind of thing. And Scott Paper was there. And at the same time, you could see poverty. You could see people who were making it. But then you could see poverty coming in, the kind of structural poverty, as it were, where the jobs are leaving, and through no fault of their own, people are without opportunity.
So you were sort of witnessing this shift that we're talking about here,
yes.
The shift to deindustrialization, and who gets left behind, and who's able to maybe be more mobile and move out and find a job elsewhere.
Yes, yes. And at the same time, I must say, people were adjusting, dealing with it.
How? What sort of things developed for people?
Well, I mean, the crime rate, it seemed, was going up. It just seemed that way. But at the same time, you had solid families. You had people who made a living and were involved in positive relations with one another, and this comity and goodwill expressed, that kind of thing. It wasn't all coming apart, so to speak. You didn't get that feeling.
And you also talk about how people in a place like Chester are blamed for their own condition often.
This is a long story. It really goes back to Elizabethan England, the idea that people are responsible for their own circumstances. We had poor laws. We had sumptuary laws, all kinds of things going way back. We had debtors' prisons. If you were poor, it was your fault. And this is something that has persisted, and it manifests itself in these notions about who's poor and why they're poor right now, the notion of responsibility and that kind of thing. You know, it's your fault. And so we get set to blame the victim, so to speak.
As opposed to?
The wider structure. And in this case, with respect to deindustrialization, a lot of people give the structural argument a pass and focus on the victim, so to speak. It's his fault. It's her fault. And yet, the jobs are not there, not the way they used to be.
And you've also talked about how when the jobs go away, other things happen. Family ties weaken, social ties weaken sometimes. And then there's sort of a problem with values, right? There's a sort of falling apart of mainstream values.
Yeah, well, I've conceptualized this in my book, Code of the Street, which is a study of why so many young people in urban ghettos are killing each other. And it's complicated to be sure. But one thing I argue in this book is that there are two different systems of law in the minds of people in the black community, one for whites and one for blacks. There's also two different economies, in a way. There's the larger economy, but there's also the inner city economy that operates at ground zero. Now, given the deindustrialization of the city, a lot of jobs are just not there for people today. And the economy of the inner city rests on three prongs, as I've been able to understand it through my field work in Philadelphia and other cities. It rests on low-wage jobs, or what's left of those. Welfare payments are what's left of those. And the third piece is the idiosyncratic, irregular, underground economy that operates at ground zero that consists of bartering, loaning money, and street crime. And the drug trade is the most lucrative part of this. Well, these elements help to circulate money in the inner city. And when the community is highly distressed, then oftentimes the person resorts to the bartering, and the begging, the street crime, you see. But these transactions that people engage in are without the benefit of civil law. Because in many of these inner-city communities, the civil law is weak or it's eroded. And in its place comes street justice, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Street credibility becomes the coin, you see, street cred. When something happens in the community, you don't trust the police because the police have let you down so many times and you depend on yourself. You have to take responsibility for your own safety and security. And you have to deal with people who might violate you by letting them know that you're not to be messed with, you're not to be victimized. But you do that by letting them know that I'm not going to call the police. I'm going to deal with you myself, you see.
Yeah, and you call that the code on the street.
The code of the street.
The code of the street.
And in the community, of course, you've got people who are decent, law-abiding, and you've got people who are deeply into the street and the criminal element. Most people in these communities, from what I've been able to see, are decent and trying to be decent. But these people are under pressure because of the abdication or the sense of abdication of the wider authorities. You're on your own. So the code of the street operates in order to get justice, in order to keep people away from your daughter, your son, your family, your car, whatever. You've got to put yourself, your body, in the void and say no. And no is backed up by street cred, which is really high maintenance. You don't get it once and for all. You've got to do it again and again and again. And so as you do it, as you transact this for street cred, violence often occurs. A lot of these fights, a lot of this violence is over street credibility because the wider authorities have been assumed to have abdicated their responsibility to the community. So you're on your own. But as you're on your own, the violence occurs.
And you've written about something called the iconic ghetto. So tell us what you mean by that and how does it apply to a place like Chester?
Well, the icon is really something that's always been with the ghetto, so to speak. Icon meaning the image, the stereotype even, that the larger society might have about the ghetto. You have a lot of people in our society today, including black people, who assume that the ghetto is where the black people live. That's a powerful thing that's been established through history, not only established but institutionalized. The roots of it go back to slavery. Slavery as an institution established the black body at the bottom of the social order, and the icon itself reinforces what slavery established, is my point. And that became institutionalized, and it's still with us to this day, especially given deindustrialization and the ways in which deindustrialization has created in many of these communities a kind of structural poverty that is no fault of the people themselves, but has to do with the fact that the jobs have simply disappeared. This is what we're dealing with right now today. And so this iconic ghetto, as it were, basically rises to a kind of symbolic racism. And this is what the middle class black community and black people who are poor too are dealing with every day.
So how does this play out in a place like Chester where really there is no black middle class?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this deindustrialization, as you say, and a large black population not doing so well, as opposed to a place like Philadelphia where there is a black middle class and places
yeah.
where...
Well, I mean, the issue really has to do with black people moving about in white space, as it were. And white space is a perceptual category. When you move out of the ghetto, when you venture outside the ghetto, there are people outside the ghetto who assume that you belong in the ghetto. And so as a black person, as you navigate the larger society outside of, say, Chester proper, then you operate with a deficit of credibility that has not necessarily much to do with your character, but everything to do with the color of your skin and the fact that your skin is associated with the ghetto itself. That's the workings of the iconic ghetto, you see. And this iconic ghetto hovers over American race relations. Every black person has to deal with the iconic ghetto. And to some extent, the initial deficit of credibility that he or she faces until he or she can disabuse white people and others that the ghetto stereotypes apply to him or her. And this is a major, major problem that we as Americans have to deal with.
You talk about people coming together in public spaces, and you have a concept of a cosmopolitan canopy. And I sense that that differs in places like Chester than it does in Philadelphia and other cities. So tell us about this cosmopolitan canopy where people come together and what it means about a community when those canopies are there.
Well, the canopy is this island of civility located in a sea of segregation. I mean, that's the main thing about it. And it privileges a kind of cosmo orientation, and all different kinds of people come to this place and essentially get along. And the Reading Terminal Market is a perfect example of that.
That's in Philadelphia, a large indoor marketplace mm-hmm. with stalls and different kinds of food.
And it's full of people from all different walks of life, sometimes from very segregated places. But they come to this place and they basically take time out from all that, and they act real nice to people who are different from themselves. And it's a beautiful place, the canopy, but it does have fault lines. And the fault lines come about when people who are deeply ethnocentric basically have trouble abiding by the norms of the canopy, so to speak. And that tension rents the canopy. And there may be an instance of acute disrespect felt by a person who is marginalized, a black person, a woman, a gay person. But when that happens, it really goes against the idea of it being this island of civility, as it were. And that happens. And pretty soon it recovers, and it's on to new things, so to speak. So it's a living thing in a way, but it's a very important model for our society. And without canopies, I think urban areas would be much less than they are.
Well, and there are urban areas without canopies. I mean, a place like Chester, as far as I know, is not rich with cosmopolitan canopies.
Right.
So what is this something that evolves in cities that are along a certain path, or is it something that we can foster in a city?
Well, the canopies I've identified in Philadelphia are pretty organic in their way. I mean, the Reading Terminal Market is organic in its history and what have you. Rittenhouse Square, organic. We can mimic this, and we've tried to do this with certain malls. The Gallery Mall was one example, which has a whole history that's very interesting, and now it's being dismantled, as
it were. This is an indoor mall on Market Street in Philadelphia that's now being renovated.
Yeah, and over time, for a lot of complicated historical reasons and money issues and what have you, it became a place for the working class, so to speak. And then it became a place for black people. And when it became a place for black people, the white people tended to stay away. And it became diverse within itself with blacks and Latinas and Latinos and other people, Asians. And it was kind of a colored place. But a lot of people saw it as a black place, you know. And the black space, the black place, was a place that white people tended to stay away from, so to speak. And it was a different kind of canopy, but a canopy nonetheless, but a different kind of canopy.
So can we foster these kinds of canopies, or is that difficult to grow it in a way that's not organic? Can we design these spaces? Can we encourage them to take
the place? Architects are trying to do that, and we do approximate that. And it may be that these kinds of spaces catch on, you see. But there's nothing quite like the Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia for being the prime example in Philadelphia as a place where all kinds of people come together and essentially get along. And the canopy is an edifying institution. It teaches some of the most parochial people to be more accepting of people who are different from themselves.
So, Elijah, you've spent 40 years or more thinking about all of the issues that we've been talking about. Where do you see progress if you could make a place like Chester a better place for people? How would you do it after this deindustrialization has happened? Where should we go from here?
Well, deindustrialization poses a big, 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 big problem for us, I believe. What we're talking about is a movement from manufacturing as a way to organize our economy to service and high technology, and all of this in the context of an increasingly globalized economy where the corporations have sent their jobs away from these urban areas to places like Mexico and then China and India and these places. And as these jobs leave, of course, that leaves an employment vacuum and leaves in its wake structural poverty. And I think the most important thing we can do is to acknowledge that. And I think we need some kind of urban economic policy to address the issue. And I'm not one who's big on solutions. I'm much more interested in describing sociologically what is going on in these settings. But I think that what we need is a kind of Marshall Plan for the cities of this country.
You know, your observations, the books you've written, the concepts that you've sort of defined for people really help the world understand how people are in cities. I know that you're not a solutions person, but how does what you do contribute toward those kinds of answers, would you say?
Well, I mean, the thing that I'm most concerned with as a scholar is trying to illuminate these conditions that people live in, to basically contribute to this conversation and to widen the conversation and maybe to shape the conversation to some extent, to make it more intelligent. And that's the best I can do. I can't tell people what to do about the problems. I know that what we need are big solutions, and certainly the issue of structural poverty needs to be addressed, not just for black people, but for all kinds of people. And if we don't address these issues, simplistic solutions become very attractive to the voting population, and then that maybe keeps us from really dealing with the issues that we need to be dealing with. I just have to believe that education is important. And I think that ethnography, and at least the kind of work I do, contributes to that civil education that needs to be there for people to appreciate one another, understand one another. I have to believe that that will help us to be better people.
Elijah Anderson is a professor of sociology at Yale University and the author of numerous books, including Code of the Street and The Cosmopolitan Canopy. Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today, Elijah, and thanks for being on Grapple.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Coming up next, we'll talk with Amy Liu from the Brookings Institution about new approaches to economic development in places like Chester.
Chester is a small community and part of a larger regional economy, and it cannot turn around its economy by itself. It cannot create every single economic activity or economic opportunity within its borders. It has to act regionally.
Amy Liu is the Vice President and Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. We're going to talk about her latest paper. It calls for new practices around the remaking of economic development, and it explores how places like Chester might actually be able to benefit from some of these new ideas. Amy Liu joins us now from the Brookings Institution studio in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Amy.
Hello, Naomi.
So to start off, just take us back to what got you interested in researching practices around economic development. What were some of the earliest experiences you had, and what kind of sparked all of this?
Well, I run a program that's focused on cities, and including small cities like Chester, and particularly cities that are part of larger metropolitan areas, in this case, the Philadelphia area. And so for 20 years, I have traveled to cities talking about how to ensure their future economic health. And this paper on how to remake economic development that generates more prosperity and benefits for workers and people and families comes out of experience I have had working with mayors and chambers of commerce and business and civic leaders, university leaders, in the wake of the recession. And I know that Chester has been part of a long deindustrialization, and so its challenges predate the recession. But the recession created a wake-up call across many of our communities about, are we growing our economies the right way? And you think about the national conversation today, there continues to be lingering questions about, are we creating an economy that works for people? And so this paper is about, how do we rethink our practices so that our citizens and our communities are better off as a result of our activities?
So let's get into, you know, what you would call traditional economic development in the U.S., which you take to task a bit. Tell us what that means, traditional economic development since World War II. Give us an overview of some of the trends we've seen since then.
For many, many years, the success of economic development strategies have been defined by jobs, 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 jobs of any kind, and jobs created whether you stole them from somebody else and whether those jobs are of good quality. Now, unfortunately, traditional economic development is too siloed, too short-term, too subsidy-driven. In other words, I find creates a lot of competition between jurisdictions, when in reality, Chester is part of a larger regional economy. And if every single jurisdiction competes for tax base, it's going to really undermine each other's economic future. Mm-hmm. So too much competition between jurisdictions and not enough alignment between economic development, workforce, and, say, neighborhood development. Short-term, much more focused on quick wins versus the long-term trajectory of a community. And when I say subsidy-driven, we tend to give away our tax base or give taxpayer subsidies to attract firms, no matter whether or not we took them away from a neighboring jurisdiction without really growing the larger pie.
And if you look at a place like Chester, where shipbuilding and other industries were very, very strong, went away for the most part, and then we see, you know, more recently, projects like a stadium, a soccer stadium, and a casino don't seem to be having that kind of robust result that you're looking for, that you're talking about. So what's going on here?
Too often, we use subsidies to support activities that are not really generating more or better incomes or quality jobs for our communities. And what I mean is a too much focus on Starbucks stadium stealing businesses. The challenge with consumption and stadia is they aren't distinctive. They don't spawn additional industries. And they're really dependent on residents having incomes in their pockets. And if there aren't other employers generating that income for residents, it's really hard for even these kind of investments to be sustained. So I would argue for a community like Chester is there's a real opportunity to go back to the basics. you know, what is really our goal here? Is it really about any kind of jobs, or do we care about the quality of jobs? And the metrics do matter on economic development. The second is it's really important to find those small and mid-sized firms in your community that could be the anchor for growth, to focus on existing firms versus extracting firms from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And there are others like that, but I think there's real potential to do something that is beyond casinos and amenities.
I think something people are concerned about, given the history of some of the cities in Pennsylvania and in the Rust Belt, is that they've been dependent on one industry, many of them, whether it's steel or coal or other things. And so there's this idea that we want to diversify more. And I'm wondering how that fits in with your recommendations.
There's no doubt that a lot of former manufacturing-based communities are really struggling to diversify. And more economically diverse communities do better. So the question is, how do you diversify off of a former industrial base? And I think there's a couple ways to go about that. One is, you know, how do we find a group of firms right now in the community, smaller, mid-size, and bring them together? You know, let's find the employers that are in our community now and better understand what they need to grow and where their growth prospects are. And we do think that the small, mid-sized firms today are really struggling with how to deal with technology changes that are occurring in their industry, or they may need more skilled workers, and we need to help them with finding and training skilled workers. So let's focus on a core group of firms that can really anchor the growth of our community. But the other is there's a lot of emphasis on now startups and entrepreneurship. And there's a great effort in Detroit, for instance, where they're bringing together entrepreneurship strategies and neighborhood development in a way that I think is really compelling and effective.
Tell us more about that.
Sure. I think Detroit is a lot like many older industrial cities. It's lost a lot of industry. It's been trying to right-size itself for a number of decades now, and it has a lot of abandoned property and vacant land. And so the question is, in a place like Detroit and in the city of Detroit, is where do you start? And one of the things that the Detroit leaders did is decide to, let's not spread all of our investments in around our community. Let's really concentrate and let's pick a couple core neighborhoods. And what we know is if we want to support the formation of new businesses, even if they are a bakery or a clothing store or other kind of small businesses, is let's concentrate them in a certain corridor or a certain neighborhood. And so there's a new program there called Motor City Match. And it is a entrepreneurship initiative that essentially matches new entrepreneurs with some really great ideas with not only venture fund and networks and support and technical assistance, but also access to vacant property and the ability to refurbish that property to retrofit into a store or whatever their new business is. And they concentrate that into a new commercial corridor. And Motor City Match now not only has served 72% of minority businesses and 64% of local residents and local entrepreneurs, but it's also revitalized whole neighborhoods as a result, bringing in foot traffic in places where there wasn't one.
And what's the timing of all this? It seems to me, because I was going to ask you about the impact of political pressure. You know, you see a lot of ribbon cuttings, you see celebrations, we're going to create 100 construction jobs and then 50 of this kind of job, and event is over, everybody's happy, nobody follows up, nobody makes sure things, you know, sort of keep the course. It sounds like what you're describing in Detroit requires a little more patience, perhaps, and a little more deliberative planning.
Yes. I think what people are asking themselves now are, did all of that work? Are we seeing job employment numbers, job creation numbers sustain? Do we see more people in jobs? Are the incomes of our residents going up? Is poverty being reduced?
And in fact, are we even measuring that? Is there any follow-up at all when we pour these dollars into traditional economic development programs? We see that in Pennsylvania a lot. There's just no tracking.
I think people are becoming more aware that the old metrics for success are not working. They're too short-term, too focused on the quick win. And I do think what people are asking now is, are our citizens better off? What if our strategies were aimed at increasing the per capita income of our residents or the median wage of our residents? If you change the metric, it does force you to change and reevaluate your strategies.
So let's go back to Chester, place of high poverty, high crime, low-performing schools. What would you do if you could sort of wave your magic wand and make the leaders do something or institute policies? And what's the best-case scenario for a place like Chester?
Well, I would say that, first of all, this isn't going to happen overnight. And it does require our leaders to come together around a new vision, but also around one or two tangible strategies. It's interesting. I travel to so many cities that want to launch economic plans and strategies. Almost every 4 or 5 years, there's another economic plan being put together. And sometimes they are plans on paper with no implementation. Sometimes they are so complicated that nothing gets done. Or sometimes there's so little distrust that nothing happens. And so Chester is a small community and part of a larger regional economy. And it cannot turn around its economy by itself. It cannot create every single economic activity or economic opportunity within its borders. It has to act regionally. It has to partner with folks in the larger Philadelphia metropolitan area. And how does Chester plug into those strategies? And how do we make sure that those regional strategies are aware of the assets or opportunities within Chester? One of them being great location, great infrastructure access to cities like Philadelphia and Wilmington, or the whole Eastern Amtrak corridor, and land available for all kinds of economic activity. So there's real assets, including Eds and Meds. Because what matters to economic growth is that a community needs to specialize in one or two industries that stand out. It needs to be creating things, making things, producing solutions for industries, whether it's computer electronics, the next wave of auto production that is tied to software development, whether it's connecting to the healthcare services and pharmaceutical industry that's along the Philadelphia area. There are ways that firms can contribute to those really value-added distinctive industries.
Stepping back specifically from Chester, how are we doing? You know, we have groups of distressed cities for different reasons in the United States. Are things getting better? Do we know how to do this better? Where are we on the continuum of improvement?
So Brookings puts out a report called the Metropolitan Monitor, where we look at the economic performance of the 100 largest metropolitan areas, including the Philadelphia area. And what's so interesting is that the 100 metropolitan areas have been growing economically since the recession. However, that job growth is not translating to better living standards or better employment and wages for workers. So I would say the big picture is that our cities, very much like the nation, are part of, you know, lackluster growth right now. And the way for us to really move forward is to be much more intentional about quality growth, more productive growth, and more deliberate about inclusion and its benefits for people, particularly workers and families of color. When we think about the future prospects of communities like Chester, the reality is that as we're pursuing all of these strategies, is the economy and the global economy is rapidly changing. And so we have to constantly adapt our strategies to reflect that reality. And if we don't, places like Chester will fall increasingly behind. And so what are those big macro forces? Well, one is technology. We are seeing huge revolutionary changes, and that technology revolution can help our industries expand, but we also know it's destroying a lot of jobs. Second is globalization. Globalization creates huge opportunities for firms, but at the same time, globalization creates more competition, and we also know it destroys jobs. The last force, though, is demographics, and we are trending towards a majority-minority nation. And in fact, we're already there among our school-age population. The majority of our school-age kids today are people of color. If our communities and our economic development strategies don't adapt to those three realities of globalization, technology, and demographics, they will be left behind.
We've been talking with Amy Liu of the Brookings Institution. She's Vice President and Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up our show. You can find our episodes on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Grapple is a co-production of Covenda Media and Keystone Crossroads, a public media initiative covering both challenges and solutions for distressed cities. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to WHYY's Al Banks and Adam Stanishevsky for engineering our show. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Covenda Media. And I'm Naomi Starobin, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.